Science Magazine of the Air presents another chapter from The Human Adventure.
Today, from the notebooks of science, one of the greatest mystery stories of modern times. The Riddle of the Invisible Eye.
It is dusk. In the chill November twilight, tired workmen are leaving a large factory, streaming down the walk and through the narrow gate in the high wire fence. Old Pop the watchman stands outside his little shack, nodding casual greetings as they pass.
Sure gets dark early now, don't it?
Yeah.
Night, Pop.
Night, boys.
See you tomorrow, Pop.
Going to the movies tonight?
Yeah. That was old lady's coming.
Hey, Bud, you. Going through the gate. I'm back here.
Oh, me?
Yeah, you. Want to see you a minute.
My chronometer, Pop. Left you.
Okay, Frank.
What's the matter, Pop? What do you want to see me about?
You know you ain't supposed to take tools out of the shop, Bud. Better unbutton your overcoat and give me that micrometer you got in your left hip pocket.
There's nothing in my hip pocket. I'll show it. Hey, I have got it up there. I must have slipped it in there without realizing it when the whistle blew.
Yeah, we all get absent-minded sometimes. Only don't let it happen again, Bud.
No, of course not. But how'd you know I had it when I didn't know it myself?
Frank spotted it as you walked past. He's inside the shack there.
Are you kidding? How could he look through a closed door and through my overcoat and see what's in my pants pocket? That's impossible.
Yeah, Bud, ain't you ever heard of X-rays?
X-rays, the invisible eye that reveals the invisible. The drama of X-rays begins 3,000 years ago when an unknown Egyptian rubbed a piece of amber to polish it. As he started to put it down, a loose feather lying nearby suddenly rose upwards to meet the amber, drawn to it as by an unseen string.
Hey! Osiris, god of the sun, protect me from evil.
What is wrong, my husband?
The feather is alive. It flew upward to the amber.
A breath of wind stirred it.
No, no, there is no wind. Watch while I bring the piece of amber near it.
You are right.
It has never done so before.
Is there a spirit in the amber? The spirit that you're loving is awakened?
I do not know. It is a haike, a magic. I do not understand it.
My husband has made a magic. I am afraid.
That was the beginning of the mystery. Centuries later, because the Greek word for amber is electra, men called this curious power of attraction electric. But in England, the year 1702, a scientist named Francis Hawksley decided that rubbing by hand was too tiresome. He mounted a glass globe on a crank and turned it at high speed with one hand while holding the other hand against it to create the necessary friction.
A clever device, Master Hawksley. Far easier than rubbing the glass by hand.
Oh, yes. With this machine, I can create as strong an electric attraction in a few moments as I could before in half an hour of hard rubbing.
But is not that globe an awkward thing to move about when you have finished drinking?
Oh, there's no need to move the globe. I found that the power of attraction can be transferred to that copper rod simply by touching the rod to the globe. Wait a moment, I'll show you. There. Oh, I've never turned it so long or so fast before. Hand me the copper rod, my friend.
Yeah.
Thank you. You see, it has no power to attract this piece of paper here. But just wait. Wait until I've touched the copper rod lightly to the glass globe.
Good heavens, Hawksley. What happened?
By my faith, I don't know.
A spark of fire. It leapt from the globe to your rod.
Yes, but how can glass give out fire? And the rod's not even warm.
A fiery spark that is not fire. This is a strange wonder, sir.
Look, look. The copper rod attracts the paper now. My friend, that spark was electricity.
What?
Electricity passing through the air from the glass ball to the copper rod. Not fire, but an electric spark.
A spark that was not fire. An instantaneous flame produced without heat. What did it mean? What was this invisible force, which, when visible, resembled something it could not be? And then in the same year in London, a famous physician and scientist, Sir William Watson, tried to solve the mystery in another way.
Egad, Sir William, that is a
curious-looking glass tube. What is it for?
An experiment, John. We know that electricity passes invisibly through wires, invisibly as a spark through the air. I'm about to see if it will pass through a vacuum.
Through a vacuum?
I've drawn as much of the air out of that tube as possible before sealing it with those two wires leading into it.
Yes.
One wire is already connected to this Leyden jar, and now we shall see what happens when I touch the other to it. So. Look, John. Look at the tube.
Oh, by the scene, Sir William, I never saw such a monstrous big spark.
Nor I. It was four times as thick as a spark in ordinary air.
Thicker and different. It looks much more like a soft flame than a spark.
Wait, let me adjust the ends of the wires farther apart inside the tube. There. Now let's see.
It works quite as well as before.
John, that spark was twice as long as any my Leyden jar has ever made in air. We've proved not only that electricity will pass through a vacuum, but that it travels more easily through a vacuum than through air.
Oh, it seems to me, Sir William, that you have merely added one more mystery to what was already mystery enough.
And though the Royal Society awarded Sir William Watson the Copley Medal for his ingenious experiments, other men agreed a spark in a glass tube was surely useless. Then in 1838, a truly great electrical experimenter named Michael Faraday remembered Watson's strange description of what happened to a spark in vacuum and discovered another mystery. Let's look into his laboratory as Faraday repeats Watson's experiment. He has a better pump than Watson had to draw the air from the glass tube. Now he is taking out more air. Much more. Is he ready to try the spark? His source of power is stronger, the voltage several times greater than Watson ever knew. Watch as he throws the switch. A soft, thick, flame-like spark shimmers and glows inside the tube. Thicker, more shimmering than any Watson ever saw. There is an eerie quality to this. A weird, unearthly beauty. Suddenly, Faraday bends closer to the tube. Stares at it unbelievingly and calls to his assistant.
Walter! Walter, come here quickly.
Yes, Mr. Faraday?
Is something wrong?
Look at the spark. Do you see it?
Of course, sir. It's most unusually thick.
But do you see? The spark does not touch the end of the negative wire, the wire it comes from. Here, look again.
Why, you're right, sir. There's a gap there, a dark space.
This is incredible. The end of the wire is covered with a soft glow of light. But between that and the spark itself, there's a dark space. Walter, this can only mean that the spark is not electricity itself. It's caused by electricity, yes. But the electricity itself is as invisible as it is in a wire. The dark space proves it.
Faraday's dark space, they called it. Knowing now that a spark is a product of electricity and not electricity itself, Sir William Crookes, a British scientist of Radcliffe Observatory, Oxford, designed a new type of tube with a flat metal plate mounted on the end of the wire from which the electricity flowed. In this tube, he had an almost perfect vacuum, and when the current flowed through it, strange things happened. That's not the spark in the tube you hear. That's the primitively geared induction coil which maintains a steady current. But even if it were not so noisy, you couldn't hear the spark because the spark has disappeared.
There is now only one small spot of light in the tube. A softly glowing little spot near the center. It is the same glow which Faraday noticed on the end of his negative wire. But amazingly, in Crookes' tube, the spot has moved away from the negative and is clearly separated from it by a new dark space. And on the other side, the Faraday dark space now fills the rest of the tube, and the spark itself no longer exists.
And now, instead of a glow inside the tube, the glass wall itself begins to emit a strange greenish light, unlike anything ever seen before. As Crookes himself reported,
the greenish light follows the magnet as it moves, yet the motion cannot be caused by the normal flow of current in the tube. Evidently, the normal flow of current has created another and separate electrical force, which seems to emanate from the negative pole.
Because because emitted from the negative pole or cathode, they are called cathode rays. What were these cathode rays? If the answer could be found, then perhaps the age-old mystery of what is electricity could be answered. And the curious idea of passing a spark through a vacuum tube would assuredly have been of some practical use. On November 8, 1895, Professor Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen, head of the University of Physics at Würzburg University, decided to investigate the nature of these cathode rays.
Carl, tell me when you are finished so I can turn on the current.
I'm almost through, Professor Röntgen. There, it is ready.
Good. And now, please hand me that barium coated screen.
Yes, Professor.
Thank you. A very bright glow when I hold it close to the aluminum window in this tube, but it fades rapidly as I move it away.
It's not glowing at all now, and it is still less than 6 inches from the tube.
That is quite in accord with the findings. The rays do not penetrate the outer air for more than a few inches. Put the barium screen back on that other table, Hal, and then you may go home.
I shall be glad to stay longer if you need me, Professor.
No, go home and get some sleep. But first, hand me that heavy black paper. I shall cover my tube with it, just to be sure.
Here it is.
First, I shall cover the crook's tube. And since it has no metal window, I shall know that this paper is light-proof.
Good night, hey, Professor.
Good night. Oh, Carl, turn off the lights as you go out. For this, I want complete darkness.
Yeah, Herr Professor. Good night.
There. If any light escapes through that paper, it will be a miracle.
In the blackness of the darkened laboratory, Röntgen inspects the paper-wrapped tube. There is no glimmer of light. The heavy paper is, beyond any doubt, utterly light-proof. He nods in satisfaction, turns toward the other table, and stops.
What is that? There is something glowing in the darkness there. It is the barium screen. How can that be? It is 3 feet from the tube. No cathode rays can affect it here. It is impossible.
Impossible, and yet it is true. For a long moment, Röntgen stares through the darkness at that strange glow. What has he stumbled upon?
Cannot be, and yet it is. It stops glowing. The moment the tube is turned off, it stops. It glows again. Something from the tube does it. But what? Not cathode rays. For in the crook's tube, there is no window for rays to pass through. What makes it glow?
You're listening to the story of X-rays, another chapter from the Notebooks of Science on the human adventure.
There it was, the crowning mystery of them all. Something was coming from the tube, something utterly unknown that pierced glass walls, light-proof paper, and 3 feet of dark air, making the little barium screen glow brightly. Although Röntgen did not know it, he had made history important to all mankind. More than 2 months later, Röntgen was asked,
Professor, what did you think when you saw that glow in the darkness?
I did not think. I investigated.
For 8 weeks, without mentioning his mysterious discovery to anybody, Röntgen investigated. Night after night, alone in the laboratory, testing, experimenting, until he was sure that he had made no mistake. Then he wrote an article for the Journal of the Würzburg Physical Medical Society.
Hey, Doctor, have you read Professor Röntgen's article? He claims to have discovered a new ray.
What kind of ray?
He does not know. He calls them X-rays. X for the unknown quantity. They are invisible, they cannot be felt, but they can pass through every known substance.
What kind of nonsense is this?
He has photographs of the shadows of a set of iron rays which were completely enclosed in a wooden box.
Amazing.
And he has a photograph of the bones of a living human hand.
The bones of a living human hand? In heaven's name, what kind of magic is this?
What kind of magic indeed?
A reporter interviews Rankin.
Professor Rankin, what makes these X-rays?
The X-rays proceed from the spot on the Crookes tube, where the cathode rays strike the glass wall. But the X-rays are not cathode rays.
You mean they originate in the glass?
That is right.
Well, are they light rays?
No.
Are they electricity?
Not in any known form.
Then what are they?
I do not know. As yet, I only know what they do, not what they are.
Dear, have you heard about these new X-rays? Well, they say they can see right through your clothes and everything.
Well, you know, Dolly, I think I'll have that old pair of opera glasses fitted with X-rays. Might be real amusing next time we go to the theater.
Tom, how can you talk that way?
Oh, well, there may be other blessings, too. If X-rays get into common use, you ladies won't bother about buying expensive clothes. The girl everybody will turn around to stare at will be the one with the prettiest skeleton.
Yes, people laughed and joked about this newest scientific discovery. At this strange, invisible eye that could see through clothes and wooden walls, through human flesh to reveal the bones beneath. But the doctors and scientists did not laugh. For in these mysterious and inexplicable rays, they saw the promise of undreamed-of uses in many fields. Within a few days after Rankin's article was published in Germany, scientists everywhere were hard at work, testing for themselves the truth of his astounding statements. Men like Michael Pupin of Columbia University, who had once started experiments with X-ray photography, and who demonstrated its medical value beyond all doubt. Months before, a New York sportsman named Butler Hall had gone hunting with friends.
Well, it's grand country hereabouts, Jim, but where are all the pheasants you promised me?
We'll see plenty before the day's over. There's bound to be some of that next field.
Well, let's climb the fence and get over there.
Okay. Now, it's barbed wire. You hold the strands apart while I crawl through, and then I'll do the same for you.
Right. Want me to hold your gun?
No, no, no. I got it all right. Now, just pull that wire high so it doesn't snag my coat.
You're an awkward duffer. All right, go ahead.
I am. I can't. Oh. Are you hurt? I didn't mean it. The trigger caught on something. Hold on, man. Did it hit you?
I'll say it did. Only my hand, thank God, but that's got the full load of birdshot. Jim, get me to a doctor, quick.
Now in Michael Pupin's laboratory, soon after the discovery of X-rays was made public, Butler Hall holds out a scarred and twisted hand and asks,
can these new rays help locate any of the birdshot that is still buried in this hand? Doctors have removed as many as they could find, but I'm still in constant pain. I know there must be others in there.
We can try. Birdshot pellets are made of lead. They should show up as dark as shadows, even against the shadows of the bones. But I can't promise anything.
I don't ask you to, Professor Pupin, but let's try.
Come over here.
All right.
Place your hand on this photographic plate while I adjust the Crookes tube above it.
Mm-hmm. Don't you even take the paper wrapping off the plate?
No, there's no need to. The X-rays go through paper as easily as light goes through glass.
Oh. Will this hurt?
You'll feel nothing. You'll see nothing unusual. But now, please hold your hand absolutely still as long as the current in the tube is on. Otherwise, the picture will be blurred. Steady now.
Have you developed the plate yet, Professor Pupin?
I have it here, Mr. Hall. Here, look for yourself.
Great Scott, do you mean to say I still have all those pellets in my hand?
28 of them, according to my count. Every one of them shows up in the photograph so clearly that a skilled surgeon can follow it the way a traveler follows a map. And remove them all.
Professor, I can't thank you enough. This is wonderful.
You owe me no thanks, Mr. Hall. This photograph of your hand should convince every doctor in the country that the use of X-ray for surgical diagnosis will be a boon to mankind.
Because almost every well-equipped physics laboratory had a cathode ray tube, the experiments were widely tried and widely publicized. Everywhere, men sought ways of producing stronger X-rays that would give clearer pictures. Men like Robert Macklett, maker of laboratory equipment, whose X-ray equipment today is outstanding in quality and precision, who found one of the first improvements over Rankin's method and brought it to Dr. Piffard of New York for testing.
Dr. Pifound, I have made a new X-ray tube. A target tube, it is called.
A target tube? What does it mean, Magnet?
It has been suggested that if the X-rays are produced in the glass wall of the Crookes tube, it must be the minerals in the glass which emit the rays. So in this tube, I've made a metal target on which the cathode rays are focused. I'm sure the metal will give off more and stronger X-rays than the glass. But will you test it to see if I'm right?
The metal target did give stronger X-rays and was soon in general use. Better and clearer X-ray pictures and shadow graphs opened new medical uses. And then, suddenly, man learned that the mystery was still a mystery. Tom, what's happened to your hand? Skin is all dried and scaly.
I don't quite know what it is, sir. Some sort of infection, I guess. It doesn't bother me any, though.
Tom, your hand looks worse.
I seem to be getting a big boil or something. Oh, don't touch it, please. It's pretty sore now.
That's the hand you usually hold in front of the X-ray screen when you're experimenting and demonstrating, isn't it?
Yes. Do you think the X-rays could have caused this curious infection?
I'm very much afraid they may have. We're taking you to a doctor at once, young man. From other laboratories came similar reports. Long-continued exposure to X-rays, the repeated exposures that enthusiastic workers naturally gave themselves in working with the mysterious new force, caused strange burns deep within the flesh, burns that stubbornly refused to heal under medical treatment.
Tom, I'm sorry, but the infection is spreading, so we shall have to amputate that hand.
In New York, Dr. Pifard was one of the first to sense the danger, and with Robert Macklett sought an answer to it.
Macklett, somehow it must be possible to design a tube that will protect the operator from the effects of these rays.
If you'll help me, I'll be glad to try, Dr. Pifard.
Well, it's plain that short exposures, such as the patient receives, have no harmful effects at all. But the operator gets a dose of them every time he uses the machine. He must be shielded.
We know that the X-rays don't penetrate lead to any appreciable extent. Why not mix a lot of lead in the glass we make the tube from? Except for a small window of clear glass. That would focus the rays downward onto the one spot over the photographic plate and cut down the radiation in all other directions.
Go ahead and try it, Maglet. But let me do the testing, not you. I don't like the looks of the skin on your left hand. Unless I'm wrong, you've already exposed yourself too often to these rays.
I don't think it's serious yet, Doctor, but it's one reason why I'd like to make a safe tube.
The Macklett-Pifard tube reduced the danger greatly, and all X-ray operators learned to avoid repeated exposures. For many years now, there have been no cases of X-ray burns, and modern X-ray machines are safe alike for patient and for operator. But the lesson came too late for many early workers. Clarence Daly, Edison's associate, was the first to die. And others, including Robert Macklett, followed him. Today, at the Röntgen Institute at Hamburg, a bronze tablet lists the names of 160 men and women of science who gave their lives that the world might know the blessings and avoid the dangers concealed in these invisible rays. But for each of those 160 lives which it claimed in the early years, the invisible eye has saved and will continue to save countless thousands throughout the world every day. Lives and pain and suffering. Its usefulness during the war cannot be told in words, for every seriously wounded soldier was X-rayed at the field hospitals just behind the front, X-rayed in a matter of seconds.
Here, this one's next, Doc. Shell fragments, leg and spine.
Right. No need to move in. We'll X-ray him right through the stretcher. Swing the machine a little lower, Sergeant, while I put a film in position.
That about right, Doc?
Yep, that'll do it. Ready?
Ready.
That's got it. Heat rests print through. and see that it's been to his chest when he's moved back to base hospital. He'll be leaving in half an hour, as soon as he saved fresh dressings. All right, who's next?
Today, you and every American take X-rays for granted in medical research. Virtually every hospital, probably your own doctor's office, perhaps your dentist, has an X-ray machine that probes and searches flesh and bone. But the use of X-rays are not limited to medical research. Industry employs them to detect submicroscopic flaws in steel, building structures, loading wires. And in the great universities where X-rays were born, in the great universities where men search for knowledge for its own sake, the study of X-rays has helped advance the frontiers of scientific learning, has helped science unlock the secret of the atom and open the door to the new atomic age of which we hardly yet realize we are a part. The story of X-ray research into the atom is but another of a thousand stories that might have been told, and in the telling, like our drama today, would symbolize the search for the truth that is the human adventure.
This program was brought to you by your Science Magazine of the Air.
Radio Service.